Shrink Wrap Radio number 380, The Three Secrets of Aging, with Dr. John C. Robinson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I will be speaking with Dr. John C. Robinson, who was my guest on episode number 354, What Aging Men Want. Today, we're continuing that theme as we discuss his book on the three secrets of aging. John C. Robinson, Ph.D., D.Min, is a clinical psychologist with a second doctorate in ministry, an ordained interfaith minister, the author of seven books on the interface of psychology and spirituality, and last but not least, an aging boomer with grown children and a gaggle of grandchildren. His professional work specialized in midlife, men's issues, the integration of psychotherapy and spirituality, the nature of firsthand mystical experience, the psychology and spirituality of aging, and the archetypal revelations of myth and fairy tale. A full-time writer now, his recent works include a memoir/narrative on the transformation potential of aging, The Three Secrets of Aging, a collection of fairy tales, Bedtime Stories for Elders, What Fairy Tales Can Teach Us About the New Aging, and a work on a new myth for aging men, What Aging Men Want, Homer's Odyssey as a Parable of Male Aging. You'll find his website at johnrobinson.org. And now, here's the interview. Dr. John C. Robinson, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be back again.
Yeah, it's great. Last time you were here, we were talking about your book, What Aging Men Want. And we're returning today to a discussion of aging. And this time it's not just restricted to men. It's more universal than that. And so, and I understand you were working on this book for 10 years. What was your process during that time?
Wow. So I was just getting older. I had a health crisis of my own that really knocked me out of my career prematurely. And then I went through this, you know, this long journey of what is this all about questions. Who am I? Where am I going? How can this be, you know, a life now for me? And in the process, I began to see that everything I was experiencing was actually kind of archetypal or universal for the aging process itself. So that got me to thinking. It helped me put it into a larger perspective. This was not just about me and something bad that had happened to me. It was about what we do in this movement from the middle-aged, you know, rat race, career success kind of thing, to a whole new stage of life.
Yeah, and you know, I had a question here to ask you where the data for the book came from, and I guess it didn't come from focus groups or individual interviews with other people, but really from the depths of your own experience.
Precisely. I've always had a kind of a bias toward anything that I truly experience deeply, I feel must somehow be representative of what people go through, because it can't just be me. And so what I did was I spelled out what it seemed like to me, and then I went through the literature, you know, trying to find parallels and other voices.
Yeah. You share the fact that you were born in 1946, which I guess places you in the boomer range, and consequently this book is primarily addressing boomers.
Yes, yeah. We've got a whole huge generation of boomers, 10,000 people every day turning 65 now, who have no idea what they're getting into.
Right. I'm actually 6 years older than you are.
And, oh, good.
Yeah, and your book certainly speaks to me, even though I'm not technically in that boomer generation. I'm not even sure what my generation name is. Do you know?
No.
I was born in 40.
Well, are you the silent generation? I've forgotten that too.
I don't know. I don't seem doesn't seem like I'm too silent here.
I think okay. The moniker misrepresents a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I like the part early on in your book where you talk about looking in the mirror and feeling like you're looking at somebody who's wearing a disguise, you know, some kind of a old guy mask. And you feel like the same person underneath, you say maybe your 30 or 40-year-old self, you say, but definitely not the age that's looking back at you in the mirror. And I have that same experience when I see photos of myself taken recently. It's a bit of a struggle to accept that that guy is me.
It's especially in photos. I think in the mirror, we can kind of fool ourselves somehow. Oh, that's just me. But in a photo, it's stunning and shocking. I have that every time I look at a picture. Who is this guy?
Okay, so it's not just me. You're right. You've tapped into something universal.
This way.
So you mentioned that it was a health crisis, and in your book, you talk about the heart attack that forced you to come to terms with your mortality and eventually that led to this book. Maybe you can share some of that experience with us here, that day when you first began to have intimations that something was going wrong with your heart. The rhythm, I think, was off.
So here it was, I'm in my middle 50s. I put in another long, long clinical day, probably too long, you know, like 8 or 9 clients in a men's group. At the end of that men's group, I just felt something kind of flip over in my chest and my, you know, I began to feel squirrely. And actually, it feels like there's a salmon jumping around in my chest. And I was in atrial fibrillation. That happened once before, like 8 years earlier. So, you know, my wife and I get in the car, drive to the emergency room, and the guy says, oh, you need to be, you know, cardioverted, which means, you know, put the paddles to the chest and shock the heart back into its rhythm. It freaked me out. And I had more dread than I could possibly expect for that procedure, because it's actually a very simple and safe procedure. Afterwards, you know, I asked the doctor, hey, am I converted successful? And he said, yes, you're Jewish. So I thought that was that bit of levity. I went on about my life, but then what happened was that I began to experience what we might call body memories of an open heart surgery that I had at the age of 14. And this open heart surgery happened literally 40 years to the month from the time of that atrial fibrillation. And gradually I began to relive the surgery itself. And I discovered in looking back and in talking to researchers in this area that I had experienced what's called anesthesia awareness or intraoperative awareness, which basically means I woke up in open heart surgery as a 14-year-old boy.
How terrifying.
It was catastrophic, and it was so catastrophic that I could not have possibly dealt with it. So my psyche, thankfully, split it off. I really had no idea that it had happened until this electrical shock seemed to stir the memories, the body memories of it. And then for several months, I kept saying, gosh, it feels so funny. My chest feels like it's all rubbery and numb. I just feel like I came out of open heart surgery, and then it hit me. This is exactly what I felt like. So for the next year and a half, I was back in therapy dealing with a long delay post-traumatic stress disorder of my own having to do with this intraoperative awareness. But the bottom line was it was so disorganizing to me that even though I tried to work another year and a half, I just could not sit in my office and listen to other people when I felt to me like, you know, my psyche was still so raw and open that I just couldn't keep working. So I retired from practice. And spent a year and a half working that out, and then I had this, you know, look at myself in the mirror in a new way and say, well, who am I now? What am I going to do? And then I became aware of, for men especially, there was this retirement crisis, you know?
Yeah.
So much of our identity and our community and our income and everything is wrapped up around this, you know, who I am in the world. And when that's gone, wow.
Yeah.
That started pretty.
Now, most of us will have some fairly dramatic, unmistakable event, such as a heart attack or other physical disability that confronts us very powerfully. What are the choices that that sort of experience presents to us? I mean, it's kind of a choice point, right? We could go.
Yeah. And I should add that, you know, it may not be a big event. It may be a small event, like, you know, joint pain or senior discounts or getting a new prescription for something or discovering you have high blood pressure. But whatever it is that shocks you into realizing that your life has changed forever, is your initiation. And so then you have, the choice point is beginning to, the big choice point is you can go into denial, like most of us will do for a period of time, where you sort of think, oh, if I just do enough exercise and, positive attitude and nutrition and cosmetic surgery, aging won't affect me. Or you can take the other more growth-oriented route, and you can ask, well, what are the tasks, the gifts, and the growth potential of this stage, and begin to look into it as a possibility for really a transformation of your whole life.
Yeah. So that's definitely the choice that we're confronted with. Now, you mentioned that you went into therapy, and I know in the book you found that very helpful. What was it that your therapist did with you that helped you to get through this phase?
I think it was really a couple things. I mean, for one, he really named it, helped me name it and claim it as my experience. It just felt like crazy making when I was going through it. And he's, just over and over, you're going through a delayed post-traumatic stress disorder. This is real, and we know what it is, and we have to work it through. And the second piece for him was, I had to relive the horror and unbelievable emotional pain of that experience. And his job really in that was to hold me, not necessarily literally, but just to hold the frame around my experience while I process these awful, awful feelings.
Yeah.
I worked most of them through.
Yeah, that's great. I've not had a horrible experience like that, but I have had so I guess it's a Valium drip that they give you when they're going to do some kind of medical procedure often. And supposedly the way it works is to erase your memory of the event. But I have had the experience of remembering some stuff, and that wasn't fun.
It's actually more common than people realize. The more I talked about this with friends, lots of other people were saying, that happened to me too. It may not be as traumatic, but the memory of it is always disturbing. And then when you begin to experience awful things, like I could feel hands working inside my heart, that is not something you want to feel.
Wow.
Or the pain of the procedure, then it's catastrophic.
Yeah. My goodness.
It's mind-numbing. What do you say next?
Yeah, there was something I was going to say, and it I'm having an elder moment and not remembering it. So you went on, after some period of time, you went on to enroll in what you describe as a very creative Doctor of Ministry graduate program developed by the noted theologian Matthew Fox. And from there, you went on to a chaplaincy institute in Berkeley. So what was the impact of these educational experiences on you?
Well, one thing, I really needed a structure and a growth-oriented, frame around me and this experience. And whenever I'm in doubt, I go back to school. I'm probably an overachiever. But both of these programs were very experiential and very interfaith. So I'm very interested in your own experience and personal growth. So in both programs, there were lots of opportunities to ask myself, what is the meaning of this event that I'm going through? And when you understand that the mystics from all traditions understand major experiences like that and understand the transformational possibilities of life, then, it gave me a positive journey to come back to myself. Support.
It sounds like you really took the time and I assume the money to create a special space, a special growth space for yourself.
Yes, that's well put. Nicely said. Yeah.
And as you point out, when we hear the word transformation, generally that has all kinds of connotations of becoming a butterfly from going from a worm to becoming a butterfly, and very positive images that we tend to envision. But you say the process was closer to dying.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about that, if you will.
Well, I really came to understand that the central archetype of aging really is death and resurrection, or death and rebirth, however you want to describe it. And you see this in fairy tales too. the transformative event at the deepest level is the realization that you're going to die, and that you're not going to, and that yourself is not permanent, and this idea you have about yourself is not permanent, and that really shakes your foundations. But it also starts you on, if you're willing, it starts you on a profound spiritual journey of, okay, then what does that mean, you know, and where and what's going to happen next?
Yes. And yeah. And you also talk about shamanism and how that death and rebirth is a theme in the whole world of shamanism and of the calling to be a shaman.
Yeah, the person called to be a shaman very often goes through a horrendous experience of where he feels himself literally cut to pieces and torn apart and devoured and killed and murdered and so forth. And when I look back on my surgery, you know, to be awake in a process where you're literally your body temperature is lowered, you are on muscle paralyzing agents, so you cannot move. Your eyes are taped shut. It is like a living autopsy, and I had an experience of death there that I think is, well, it was undeniable, but I was not old enough to process it. I was too young to get that, so it took the 55, 60 year old me to really begin to unwrap that again and see that that was an initiation for me as an adolescent that was unfinished, and it needed to be finished now in my 60s, because the movement from limited years to later years is a process of initiation into a new dimension of life, and this turned out to be my initiation. But it was incomplete, because initiation needs a ritual as well.
You know, you just triggered that thought that I wasn't able to grab hold of earlier, which is that even for those of us who don't have a memory of, say, a major surgery or something like that that we've gone through, that memory must be in the body.
And yes.
So it's got to be there somewhere doing some kind of mischief in a way.
Yes, I agree. Sure did for me.
Yeah. Yeah, so you went through these two educational experiences of the chaplaincy training and the ministry training, and then eventually something new began to emerge. You write, "Then unexpectedly, in this emptiness, I begin to notice subtle and spontaneous changes and consciousness expanding, moments of silence, stillness, and timelessness moments, when it seemed as if the mystery of eternity was leaking into the everyday world. I was moving into a curious and peaceful space, consciousness without thought and awareness devoid of purpose, effort, agenda, point of view. These changes, which have been emerging unappreciated for some time, seem to increase when observed and eventually become harbingers of my new kind of consciousness and a new kind of life, intimations of spiritual transformation." So I was really struck by that passage. I thought it was really beautiful. And do you want to add anything to that?
No. I'll just sort of paraphrase a little bit, only that there's a bunch of subtle changes, I think, that happen to us in these years where we slow down, you know, and our mind is not cluttered with our identity and our goals and our purposes, you know, and the schedule and time and clocks and all that kind of stuff. And we can stop and smell the roses. And in that smelling the roses kind of experience, you're really waking up. You're getting back in touch with sensation. And sensation, you know, tuning into sensation automatically stops thinking. You know, like when you get arrested looking at a beautiful sunset or you know, you're just absolutely transfixed by a new rose coming up with the sun shining on it. That kind of transformation stops your mind, and then you begin to notice the experience of consciousness. So I came to believe that the process of aging is a kind of a dissolving of identity, time, and story, all the things that structure your mind. And as those things begin to fade away, you become, if you're willing, aware of consciousness itself, which is an astounding experience, as all the mystics and meditators will say. It's an amazing reality. You discover that consciousness then is not really in me. I am in it, and it is not my consciousness. It is a larger consciousness. It is cosmic consciousness. It is a consciousness of the universe. wow, that will take your breath away, not only to experience it, but to become aware of its implications.
Yeah. Now, you also refer to that experience, I think, as the experience of presence. And
yeah.
So that's interesting. The presence of what?
Well, the presence is the consciousness of the universe, and you can call it God or cosmic consciousness or you know, Yahweh. There's a million names for it, mystical consciousness. But it is, I mean, when you tune into it, you realize that it's you don't own this. This is much bigger, and it includes you. And as you learn to live in a thoughtless, spacious consciousness, you know, you become aware that it's aware of you, and you're aware of it, and you're aware of it's being aware of you, and things begin to change. It's like living in the presence. And the presence, as I wrote it, I had a neat previous book called Ordinary Enlightenment, which talks a lot about the presence. But in the presence is always a sense of peace and comfort and joy. And from that space, your feelings about other people and the kind of life you want to live change radically.
I have to ask about fear, because I'm aware that there's a lot of fear in me. When I sort of get deep down or in the middle of the night, it comes up. What's the relationship, you know, of what you've been talking about to fear? I mean, it sounds like fear is not present during those periods.
You're correct. Yeah, when you're in that state of fear, you're in a state of bodily contraction. You know, you grip yourself and you tighten up. It's an automatic, you know, bodily response to threat. I mean, all us animals do it. But when you shift from that kind of orientation to the space of consciousness itself, you begin to realize that that's not you. That's just a sensation floating in space, and you can release it. And it will take some practice, but every time I release that state, I discover this incredible feeling of happiness. And it's like a 0 to 60 shift from, oh man, I'm scared of this, to this doesn't even matter.
Yeah, that's great. I find what works for me is bringing myself into the presence. That fear typically is a worry about something in the future.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
So the title of the book is The Three Secrets of Aging, and these are personal secrets that you discovered, but that you also have the strong intimation that they're pretty universal. So, you know, I feel like I should whisper or something. What's secret number one? Tell us about secret number one.
Okay, so secret number one is that aging is an initiation into an extraordinary new stage of life. And the secret says, the events and processes of aging, changing bodies, fading identities, losses of all shapes and sizes, represent an initiation into an entirely new dimension of life, a time of personal and spiritual growth unprecedented in human history. While aging may represent the end of our old life, it is also the beginning of a new one.
But now, one of the things that you notice, that you note, is that we don't have any institutional rituals, markers, etc., for this movement into aging. What are we to do about that?
Oh, I think we need to create them. We have some superficial ones like retirement parties or 65th birthday parties or 70th birthday, but they never go deep enough. I think we need to create rituals. And in What Aging Men Want, I had a whole appendix on how to create your own initiation ritual.
Oh, yes, I remember that now.
So I think was one of our collective tasks of this age range. And you can't really do it alone, because it needs to be a community experience, and it needs to be a sacred experience in some way. So you gather your really good friends, and you tell them you're really needing to make this transition or to have this transition blessed in some way. And together you begin to create a process or a ritual that blesses your old life, that recognizes and honors and, you know, congratulates you on what you did and who you are, allows you to make amends and allows you to work out, you know, the past, because you've got to leave the past or you won't go into this new stage. And then the ritual needs in some way to help you move across into a new vision of what your life could be. And for me, that happened when I was ordained. I think I just stumbled into it because I've done this work, and I've done this work to become an interfaith minister. But the ordination itself was so beautiful. I mean, there was drumming and color and pageantry, and all the people I loved were there, and I got to do an ordination sermon. And it was like, this was the blessing that I had needed to move from who I used to be to who I am now.
Yeah, that you make it sound wonderful. It's not something I ever wanted to do for myself. Couldn't quite imagine myself doing that. But the way that you describe it, it does sound very special. I guess I have all these old leftover negative associations to, that are wrapped up in traditional religious perspectives. And
yeah, I've been formerly religious.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I've always been a mystic. I belong to the mystical branch of every religion. But I feel like it becomes problematic when you turn it into theology and doctrine, and then we can have wars.
Yes, exactly. Now, related to what you were speaking about earlier, you talk about the need for enlightened elders. How do we become an enlightened elder rather than just an old person?
Yeah, the wisdom literature from around the world really says you don't get wise just by being old. And we know, all of us know old people are not very wise. They just continued in their same personality styles and belief systems. So the work of aging is an inner work, a transformational work on yourself, on the tasks of aging that are both psychological, spiritual, and mystical. And people don't lay this out well enough. So when I give talks on this or workshops, they're so grateful to hear that there's something they can do about this experience. And the work that they do are these tasks like how do you let go of the identity and role to the middle years? How do you discover the language and wisdom of the aging body? How do you learn to grieve and survive? These are the kinds of tasks that help us reorient ourselves to this next phase. Then we become wise. If you don't do those kinds of things, if you grow the unfinished self and do a life review and find a hidden meaning of change, and these are the kinds of things I list in the book, and open the heart, my gosh, you will be wise because you've done the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I really recommend the book for that because you spell a lot of that out, and you have a section on the tasks of aging, and you also write about the gifts of aging. So say something about that.
The gifts of aging are amazing. I mean, some of the simplest ones are just like, assuming you do the work, are things like increased happiness in a slower, more relaxed life. All the research literature says that this stage of life is a lot happier than the last one, and there's a sort of a bell curve that we were happier as kids than we were in these middle years, and then as we get older, we become happier again. That's one of the wonderful gifts. And then, the confidence to survive tragedy, the greater patience we learn dealing with problems, far less concern about what anybody else thinks of us. We have new interests and hobbies. The unfinished self is beginning to grow again if we support it. There's a reorganization of personality. I mean, the gifts, I list 10, but there's probably about 30. I love this thing because this is also a gift to an audience where you say, gosh, get ready. If you do this work, these are the kinds of things you're going to come out with.
Yeah, that's great. I had an experience just the other night where I was in a situation where I was watching a choir. It was an interfaith service that I went to with my wife, and there was a choir standing up front of, maybe 12 to 15 individuals, mostly gray-haired people in the choir. And I had the experience of seeing them as children. And I think this is maybe a perspective that comes with aging, at least it has for me, that I could see them as children, despite the gray hair or the beard or the wrinkles. I could just see their bodies. I could shrink them down and really clearly imagine what they looked like as children. And also the other experience that I've been having more and more is when I see children, I can see what they're going to look like as adults.
Gosh, I have the same two experiences. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
Kids say, go through all these phases, and then he's going to look like this, and he's going to fall in love, he's going to have this work. I mean, it's like, wow, you really get a feeling for the life cycle.
Yes. Yes.
That's lovely.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that somebody else has had that experience. It's always reassuring to know that somebody else has had the same kind of an experience.
I really recommend mentoring or support groups for all of us. I've been in several, because you say things like that, and other people say, yeah, you know, I didn't tell anybody, but I felt the same way. It's very liberating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm in a men's group, have been for a long time, and it occurs to me, both from talking to you now and from reading your book, I might just suggest that we reorient ourselves in our group and talk about these issues a bit more. So often we drift into talking about world crises and politics. And
yeah.
I always get a little impatient with that.
I am the worst instigator in our group, because I just can't stand that kind of talk. So when we people drift off into the insurance crisis or whatever, I say, okay, stop. What personal check-in, feelings, what are you feeling right now? What's going on in your life?
Yeah, that's a good reminder. Well, let's go on to secret number two that you discovered, which you describe as aging as a transformation of self and consciousness.
Yeah, so the secret says, aging is enlightenment in slow motion. It begins spontaneously, naturally, subtly. As we wake up from the illusions of mind, we transition from personal identity to the consciousness of divinity, giving birth to the enlightened elder. So when we look at transformation, I mean, you can look at it in terms of the body, self, and consciousness. And the body stuff is obvious. Take off your clothes and look in the mirror, and you'll see a transformed body. Shockingly so. And so we talked about the self, you know, how the self, you know, the self idea, the idea of who you are, comes apart, because you're no longer the parent, because your kids are grown. You're no longer the worker, or you will not be soon. You're no longer the young man who can run marathons. You're no longer a bunch of stuff. So that goes away. And then the spiritual dimension is what I said is really amazing. So as this empties out and you become aware of awareness, you know, you just sit in the backyard and the sun is on you when you're reading, and you put the book down, you look out at the green, or in my case, out at the sound, and your mind stops, and you begin to experience something larger. That's it. That's that consciousness that I was talking about.
Yes. So, you know, the word enlightenment is so loaded.
Yeah.
And some people seem to use it to indicate a kind of a permanent state of, you know, of being and almost unnatural permanent bliss. I tend to think that it's something that kind of comes and goes. What's your view of it?
Oh, yes. It's, you know, nobody retires in enlightenment. Enlightenment doesn't solve all your problems. It's an awakening of consciousness that you can then interact with or facilitate. So in the midst of something going on, someone cuts you off on the road, You can do a practice as simple as reminding yourself to stop thinking, because you're going to run your mind if you keep, you know, thinking about what he did to you and so forth. Stop thinking, heighten awareness, experience the world the way it really is. I mean, come back to the world, open your senses to what is, and then step into the presence. And that takes you into a consciousness that allows you to see the world and yourself in a new way. The world begins to become brighter and more beautiful, more profound. You take that deep breath because you just released the whole thing that just happened, and so that you're able to bring yourself into a higher state of consciousness that has everything those major enlightenment experiences have. The big mystical experience still happens all the time in the world to people. I know a lot of people have had the big one that's unbidden, but this kind of intentional process of taking yourself into that consciousness reveals all the same stuff, just not quite as intensely or as powerfully.
Okay.
So and it happens more, my hunch is that it happens more as we get old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You talk about the tasks of spiritual transformation during this stage two of the process. What are some of these tasks?
Okay, so the tasks of spiritual transformation, let me see if I can find the ones here. Yeah, so, I mean, there are things like this. Disbelieving thought. One of the problems we have is that we always believe what we think, and our thinking is so conditioned from the culture and from past experiences. As soon as we think something bad has happened, we think it's really true, and then we react because we've told ourselves that. So disbelieving thought is like, you know, stop thinking, let that go, and then moving to experience the consciousness behind thought, or the consciousness in which everything arises, and then seeing through the illusion of the personal self, this idea of you is such a fiction. All our lives we've been creating this story about ourselves. Oh, this happened to me, oh, then she did that, and then this, that, he did this. So we create this whole story that we believe is true. Well, a different personality type could have written an entirely different story. A different culture, a person from another culture would have written an entirely story. And in any case, when you stop thinking, it all goes away anyway. So part of it is beginning to let go of this whole process of believing in who you are. And then related to one is to release this contraction that we talked about earlier, this fear contraction, and then transcend our attachment to it and other things. These are the kinds of processes that help us not fall back into the rut of old patterns and habits, but instead to begin to see the world from this more enlightened perspective.
Yeah, you know, a personal experience that I've had that maybe fits in somewhat with what you're saying is that I've kind of gotten tired of my story. you know, I used to sort of treasure my wonderfully painful story, you know, like a smoothly polished river stone that I could that I could bring out, and I'm kind of tired of that. It's lost its big charge.
Yeah, it's boring. It's old. Been there.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who's just turned 85, and he tells me that there are pieces of his story he can no longer remember.
Yep.
But
yeah.
On the inside, he still feels like he's about 30. So this stuff drops away anyway, and I would encourage people, don't worry about this being dementia. This is a gift. This is a possibility of letting go of this stuff you've been hanging on to.
Oh, that's a good perspective. I'm gonna remember that. Now, you have an intriguing section called Everyday Living Without a Personal Self, and you raise an interesting question, which is, how do you live without a personal self? Well, how indeed?
Well, you know, we do that all the time. That's what's so remarkable about this. When you dance, when you trim flowers, when you, paint trim. The things you do, make love, all that you do, you're not thinking, oh, this is me doing this, oh, I should be doing it this way, I'll not accept the way I'm doing that. You just do it. The self idea is sort of an overlay that complicates things. My dog does all sorts of stuff very, very sophisticatedly without a self.
Yeah.
You know, gee, he disapproves of me now, I'm not a good enough dog, you know? We do this. It's amazing. We have developed a left hemisphere with such language capacity that we swap everything we do with concepts, so that we no longer see the world. We see our ideas about the world. We see stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
And this is what waking up from.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well said. I particularly resonate to the dog.
Me too.
Yeah, I look at dogs with wonder. You know, they're beings who exist with us, and they tend to love us unconditionally. And such soulful eyes, and they're just there. They're just there in the moment. Well, let's get into what you discovered as secret 3, in which you say that aging is the revelation of heaven on earth. So tell us about that.
Okay, so you might say it's the most controversial, but I think if I explain it, you'll begin to see it, how it is. You know, this idea is an idea that the culture just doesn't understand, but it's entirely demonstrable to yourself. Anyway, the secret says, as the veil of thought dissolves in conscious aging, heaven on earth begins to shine everywhere, and the world is sacred once again. We have come home from our long journey through the world of thought and invite others to join us in a new consciousness of creation. So when you So as I was saying a moment ago, when we look at a tree, and instead of seeing the tree, we see we name it, we the type of it, we think what, how much lumber we can get from it, we walk on to the next tree. We don't really see the tree. We don't relate to the tree. If you stop thinking, heighten awareness, come in, into the tree as it is, and look at it intensely in a thought-free consciousness, you discover that the tree is incredibly beautiful. The colors, the smell, the touch, your hand. Look at your hand in great and detail with intense consciousness, and you realize, my God, what a miracle this is. So, you know, it's not just waking up to smell the roses. It's waking up to see that the world is still a radiantly pristine, divine place. You know, the words, the garden never left. We just left it with all these ideas of me and who I am and what I have to do and what's wrong with the world and how I got to improve myself. When we stop all that and come back to the world, we find out that it is spectacularly beautiful. It's infinitely precious. And then we have a new relationship to the world, and it becomes a sacred place.
So what can we do either to initiate or to increase our experience of heaven on earth? Well, I guess you sort of spoke to that, say, by really focusing on it.
It's the kind of thing that you can practice, you know, every moment of the day and all the time. You can look at, when you look at your dog, take a moment to, you know, not just look at your dog and pass on, sit down and really look at your dog and look in his eyes, and you will discover that this is a beautiful creature that is full of energy, a special kind of energy and a special kind of wisdom. And that's true for everything out there, for trees and rocks and birds and friends. And so when you begin to see from this non-conceptual awakened consciousness, the world begins steadily to change in your own perception. You don't have to take my word for this. Just practice. I remember Joe Campbell was talking about one day about picking up a pencil and just looking at it and discovering that he really didn't know what it was at all. Once he got his concepts erased and really just looked at it, it was an amazing thing, this pencil.
Mm-hmm. The last...
Yeah. This is like you can spend all day playing in the mud.
Yeah, right. The last part of your book returns to the theme of the enlightened elder in the 21st century, and you offer what you call a spiritual blueprint. Maybe you can take us through the highlights of that.
Yeah, let me find that here, because I really wanted to find a way to say, what does all this mean? I mean, why would we even do this? I think we are living in a world, and you see it every day in the news, of just you know, incredible change, of a constant upheavals and roiling disruptions of everything, a cataclysmal process of change. And what do we do about that? And I believe that elders are particularly important is this. If they begin to shift from conventional reality to this more enlightened consciousness, we can be the harbingers. We can be the ones who begin help start changing the culture. We have a culture of warrior competition. It goes on all the time. That's what the book, What Ancient Men Want, talked about, that we are constantly living in a battle. With boys, we all learn it from the earliest age. We need to begin to let go and return to our senses. And in our senses, we begin, as I was just saying, to see that the world is not what we thought. It's not a place of dangerous people. It's actually a place of beauty and wonder and precious, you know, everything's precious. So as we return to our senses, the world changes, and as we include more people, it needs to be a place of full inclusion. We are changing the world, and we can begin to show, especially our grandchildren who are not yet so fully indoctrinated, that there's another way to live in the world. And I think as this proceeds, we'll begin to make changes in our culture, not the top-down changes that politicians try to make, but the bottom-up changes, like you do from a men's group or in a family, where you just sit around and say, what needs to go on here? And when you listen to every voice, and every voice matters, we begin to realize that everybody has valuable stuff to contribute, and everybody will be helpful in creating this new world. So we're on the edge of a profound change in culture if the elders can stay awake and not retreat to gated communities, not disappear, but come back into the world as wisdom figures.
Yeah, there is so much segregation of elders, both on the part of elders themselves and also by society, kind of not recognizing the resource that they represent. Although I guess that's changing. I'm reading, you know, articles in the newspaper from time to time about businesses is supposedly discovering that there's a great resource out there that they can tap.
Yes, yes. Right. Well, and we have more organizations like Rabbi Schachter Shalomian's group from Aging to Saging, and there's a lot of really wonderful websites like Second Journey that talk about that, really bring forth this new kind of perspective that is so encouraging. My gosh, we have a grim view of aging from the past when it really was grim. And so we automatically have all these fears that it's the end of the road, we're going to die, it's going to be terrible. And so we're steadily, from the personal experience of aging itself, changing our expectations of what this time can be. We have, you know, it's a new developmental stage, for gosh sake. We have 15 to 20 years of more life on the average than our parents or any generation before. So what are we to do with this wonderful time? That's what we're here for. That's what we're here to talk.
Since many of our listeners are either psychotherapists or psychotherapists in training, what are the implications for psychotherapy of what we've been discussing here?
I think they're incredible. I'm about to start doing some continuing education workshops on this as soon as I get my hip surgery done. But I think therapists typically have the same kind of unconscious, unspoken ageism. You know, old people, and you're afraid of death, and there's not much more you're going to be doing, and maybe you should, you know, spend more time on a hobby. Maybe you could get that HOH train set, you know, built in your basement. You know, if they will go through, for example, this book on the paths of aging and look at those as what their aging clients are actually working on, then they'll begin to see their clients as, wow, this is a growth thing. It used to be thought that aging people had nothing left to do. They were just going to ossify. So you don't really give them therapy unless it's kind of palliative. But now, with all this time and with this new perspective, I think we can, as therapists, can create a much richer environment for our aging clients.
Okay, well, that's a good charter to send us off with. I think I've run out of ammunition here. I wonder if you have any final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with.
First of all, I should do a plug that says if you want to know more, come to www.johnrobinson.org. JohnRobinson.org to learn more about this, because I've got like three books on aging and more behind that. But what I want you to take away from this is to not be afraid, to be cautiously excited, and to, you know, if you will look at these growth tasks and begin to look at the ones that like call you, like one of them is like, yeah, I want to do that one. So you start with that one, and then that kind of gives you a kind of a thrust and a boost, and then you realize, well, you know, I could do that one next, and you do the life review one, and pretty soon you find yourself feeling like, wow, this is a new life for me. I got more freedom than I've ever had in my life. I've got more potential, more resources. I don't have to sit around, you know, in my office and wait for the end.
You know, I probably should have asked you this earlier on. What about for younger people? I mean, is this a book? Is this conversation, does it have relevance for those who are still young?
Oh, absolutely. I think they might. I mean, I think that our kids, our grown kids, could really understand us a lot better when they see what we're working on, because they unconsciously have the same cultural ageism. Gee, you know, they can say, Dad, I understand that you're now, you know, doing a life review and you've kind of written about the chapters of your life. What did you learn? I can't wait to hear what you've discovered about yourself. Hmm. I would love a conversation with my kids.
Yeah, yeah. Did you say you have had that conversation with your kids?
I haven't. I want to. They're so busy, you know, there's a problem of, you know, kids and work and stuff. And they really can't afford to look at it too much. But I think, especially as we get even older and our kids look at us as, quote, responsibilities or things they have, people they have to take care of, that's when they especially need to be confronted that, you know, I'm not a responsibility, I'm a friend. And let's work on how we can, you know, look at my aging in a productive, exciting way, not in a way. You know, isn't it time you moved into a nice assistive living program? there are lots of ways to age in place. You don't have to do that unless of course you really want to. I should also say that there are as many ways of aging as there are people who are aging. So there's not a wrong way, okay? And there's not a right way. There's your way. Just make sure that it's meaningful to you. If the journey is meaning.
Well, that's a great note for us to finish on. So, Dr. John C. Robinson, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Love to be here.
I find John's take on the positive opportunities of aging quite inspiring. It's clear, however, that to reap the sorts of benefits he describes takes more than just getting old. It requires developing practices and habits of mind, such as gratitude and generosity. And the sooner one starts to develop these, the better. So for that reason, I think his book has relevance not just for those who consider themselves old, but also for young folks who think old age is some almost imaginary, distant remove. I remember the Beatles song, "Will You Still Love Me When I'm 64? I was in graduate school when I first heard that song, and it seemed like a catchy, upbeat tune at that time, but not a reality I could seriously envision. Now, I'm well past that impossible age of 64, and I can tell you it does come, and, in retrospect, faster than you think. So it's never too soon to start developing the psychological and spiritual qualities you'll need for smooth sailing in the turbulent waters to come. If you haven't already heard it, I'd recommend my earlier interview with John in Shrink Wrap Radio number 354, What Aging Men Want. Another excellent and reinforcing companion piece to this interview is my interview with my very dear friend Dwight Webb, in Shrink Wrap Radio number 313, Building Heaven on Earth. As always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site to order The Three Secrets of Aging by John C. Robinson.
Hello, fellow Shrink Wrappers. I have a couple of questions for you. Do you think that Dave is doing a good job? Well, I do anyway. And do you wish for him to continue producing these podcasts? I sure do. So, are you willing to support him? I just did. It's easy. Go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Click Support on the top menu. Select the amount you wish to contribute. If you have a PayPal account, enter your credentials. If you don't have a PayPal account, you can still do one-time donations by just entering your credit card details. PayPal will take care of the rest. David will be happy. And we will all get the benefit of his excellent guests and his well-honed interview skills. Now to my last question. When will you do it?
Thank you, Sven in Sweden. And I made it easier for you to answer Sven's question of when will you do it. Now, if you will click on the support button in the right-hand sidebar, you'll see I've added a new support option called the guilt-free level for $12 a year. That comes out to be just $1 a month for access to all 380 episodes plus all the transcripts. Keeping all this going has turned into the equivalent of a half-time job for me. If everyone who enjoys the benefit of my labor were to at least subscribe at this guilt-free level of $12 a year, that would actually generate a reasonable half-time salary. Now, I assume there's no one out there who can't afford a dollar a month. If you're listening to this show, I assume you either have been able to afford a computer or a smartphone or a tablet. So surely you can spare a dollar a month for this content that you enjoy. Please go to the support page on our site and enjoy guilt-free listening. And of course, you should also feel free to join those who are supporting at a higher level. But at the very least, spring for a dollar a month. And I thank you. And speaking of thank yous, thanks again to Gloria Ullman, who has produced yet another transcript in record time. She's blessed us with the transcript for Shrink Wrap Radio number 377, which is my interview with Jungian analyst James Hollis about his book, Hauntings, Dispelling the Ghosts Who Run Our Lives. And by the way, you'll see an ad for Dr. Hollis's book in the right-hand sidebar on the site, and you can order the book from Amazon directly by just clicking on that ad. And it's such a wonderful, deep, and powerfully written book, which also might make a great holiday gift for someone you know. Today is Thanksgiving here in the United States, although you probably won't hear this episode until a week later or more. The value of gratitude has been extolled in many of the interviews you've heard here. So whether you live in the U.S. or not, I invite you to join in the Thanksgiving. Among the so many things I'm grateful for is the devotion and support of you, my listeners. And I'm also grateful to all the guests who've shared with us their knowledge, wisdom, and insight over the past 8 years.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kira. I'm so grateful for you and for all my children and grandchildren. What a blessing you all are in my life. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Tyke, who writes, "Hello, Doc. I've been listening to your podcast for about a year and find the show very enlightening. You're a great interviewer and really get to the heart of whatever matter you happen to be covering that episode. This is why I would really like you to do a show on the treatment of disorders like PTSD through the use of the psychedelic drugs MDMA. I know this is a bit of a taboo subject since all of the experiments done in the 60s, but research seems promising so far, and I personally have a lot of faith in the methods and their potential positive effects in combination with psychotherapy. I am a freshman in college and aspiring to become a psychotherapist of the Jungian perspective. Please recommend me some good colleges in the U.S. or Canada where I could study the Jungian perspective also. Thanks a bunch." And that's from Tyke. And Tyke, thank you for this inquiry. And actually, I have an upcoming interview within the next few weeks with Ralph Metzger, who is someone who's very steeped, I believe, in the psychedelic research. I believe he was a graduate student under Timothy Leary and has continued to have interests in consciousness and related subjects. And so I think he would be very knowledgeable about that, and so I'll want to try to remember to ask him about that. As far as a school that has a Jungian perspective, you could get some of that at Sonoma State University, where I taught for so many years, so you could look into that program. There would be maybe two or three courses in the psych major that would, you know, that might come from that perspective. The department has changed somewhat since I retired. I'm not sure if Pacifica Graduate Institute, so I guess they don't have anything at an undergraduate level. I would say it's hard to find at the undergraduate level. You might have to wait till you get to the graduate level. But I don't know everything that's out there, and there might be some other possibilities. You're just going to have to keep researching it. Next, we hear from Bella, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've been listening to your podcast for over a year now, and they continue to influence not only my life, but the lives of my friends and family as I talk to them about books and ideas you share in your interviews. I'm a former psychology major, and although I have chosen to work in a different field, psychology remains one of my great loves. I've meant to contribute a long while ago and decided to finally press the button as I continue to be grateful to have access to the information you provide. I will be happy to record something for you and we'll call the number as you suggested shortly. Sincerely," and that's from Bella. Bella, thanks for that positive feedback and also for your contribution. Now, I still haven't received that audio file yet, though, so help me out. I'll be looking for it. Maybe you'll hear this and that'll be a good reminder. Next, we hear from Zach, who writes, "Hi, David. Thank you very much for all your podcasts. I'm still working my way through many interesting interviews in your archive. Two people I would love to see you interview are Peter Levine, who I know you've tried to get, and Bill Plotkin. His new book, The Wild Mind, and discussion of his Animas Valley Institute would be very interesting for your listeners, I'm sure. Loved the Hollis interview, have read many of his books, and really appreciate his insight and, as you recognize, his wonderfully poetic presentation. Thank you. And that's from Zach. And Zach, you're right. I continue to try to get Peter Levine, but it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. In the meantime, I am going to be interviewing one of the trainers in his approach who's been recommended to me as very good. I believe his name is Larry Heller. I may be wrong about that, but I'm not taking time now to look it up. But I have scheduled an interview with him. And I did look up Bill Plotkin, and that sounds like a good recommendation as well. So we'll see as time goes along. Next, we hear from Barclay, who writes, Dear David, since my original fan mail to you almost a year ago now, my appreciation and admiration for your podcasts have persisted. I continue to marvel at the sustained effort you must spend on behalf of your very lucky listeners to produce such stimulating, thought-provoking, high-caliber interviews. And now, after I recently discovered the podcast with your son, Jonathan, my ongoing regard for you has vaulted to even loftier levels. I found Jonathan's story to be profoundly moving. He deserves enormous respect for enduring such unfathomably daunting challenges and then for deciding to go public with them. What he has been able to transcend in order to build such a thriving life is beyond remarkable. The usual superlatives fall far short of conveying the absolute magnitude of what he has achieved in both his personal life and his professional endeavor. I feel extremely fortunate to have shared in such an inspiring tribute to your son, to your family, and of course to you and your own work. Thank you for your generosity. And that's from Barclay, who is in both Ocala, Florida and Colusa, California. Barclay, thank you so much for your tribute to me and to my son, Jonathan. It means a lot to both of us. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. John C. Robinson, for gracing us once again with his insights into the positive opportunities for growth presented by our aging. And on the next episode, our focus will once again shift to the magical world of our nighttime dreams. I'll be speaking with Dr. Stephen Fox, who is the author of the new 2013 book, Dreams, Guide to the Soul. So see you then. And meanwhile, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.